Between the time when the brown-headed turtle first touched cloth and the rise of the Sons of Peachstone, there was an age undreamed of. And unto this came Vince, Tony, and Dan, three who had forged the awesome comic podcast destined to conquer the kingdom of iTunes. It is I, their chronicler, who alone can tell thee of their saga. Let me tell you of the days of high adventure.
Hello and welcome to episode 114 of the Awesome Comics Podcast, the place where small press comics make one hell of a big noise. I'm Vince Hunt, creator of The Red Mask from Mars, and joining me for this week's journey across the barbaric plains of comics are the creator of the epic superhero webcomic, Dan Butcher.
Hello. I've got a laugh at you then.
Yeah, I was going to say, hello. The creator of the epic martial arts vixen Soho Red, Tony Esmond.
Hello.
That was fairly normal for Tony. And this week, we're joined by the creator of an awesome pod favourite, the mighty Imurian Tales, the second book of which is launching at Thought Bubble this very year. It's our pleasure to welcome MD Penman, or Mark to his friends, to the show. Hello.
I told you not to say my real name.
Oh, sorry.
You are.
You're Mark.
Allow me to say, it's not a secret my name's Mark. That was all we heard. Just before we came on air, he's done us.
Properly done us.
Hello, everyone.
Yes, I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who are big fans of the strip, the webcomic, etc. We've talked about it a few times on the show.
Yeah.
And yeah, we're looking forward to getting into it, as well as all your influences and the fantasy genre in general.
Yeah.
So it's going to be awesome. So that'll come in a minute. But once again, it's time to thank our friends at Comic House for helping us keep the lights on in Awesome Pod HQ. Yes, there's an HQ.
I don't know why. The lights out.
It's metered. It's the place. Well, Comic House is the place where small press creators can list and sell their books to the masses. It's easy to add your work to the database and easy to purchase titles from your favourite indie creators. Now, if you head on over to the website, you'll see titles like Brain Shoodles from Emily Owen, Chicken versus Mutant Bull, yes, I said that right, by Jonathan Claude and Sean Wagner, and the new Marcosia book, and one of our faves, Impossible, by Chris Sides and Jake Rowlinson. All of which, nice. They're in the featured section. Which also,
you know,
includes...
when you interviewed Sidesy, I didn't recognise his voice, and I see him all the time. he had such a sore throat, didn't he?
Yeah,
he did.
Yeah. He sounded properly sexy. If you listen to our London Super Comic Con episode, which was last week, I can't believe it feels so far away.
It does.
But you could hear his lovely dulcet tones, which made him sound like Batman from the Christopher Nolan films.
Yeah, it did. Mm. Yeah.
But his brilliant book, and it is brilliant because I've read it and it's awesome, Impossible, is on the features section. And the feature section also includes the Awesome Comic House anthology too, which is, there's been a few people that have been on the show that are in that, so you should definitely check it out. So check out comichouse.com to find out more. And also, if you're a creator who hasn't claimed your creator profile on their site yet, be sure to go ahead and do that now. And I'm holding my hand up and I need to do it properly myself. So... because the beta launch of the Comic House app is going in a couple of weeks.
Nice.
So get all your creator profiles ready.
It's so soon, is it? Oh, good.
Yeah.
So if we back the Kickstarter, do we get the beta? What's a beta launch mean? I don't know what that means.
Basically, you get all the comics on a Betamax videotape.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
I've still got my player here.
I thought
you
would
have. Play and pause each page.
Yeah. Oh, that's good.
Yeah, the tracking's off. Oh.
Yeah. This is a whole new world.
It's amazing. It's the future, like garlic bread. Now, I've wanted to get Mark on the show for a while now. I've been trying to sort this out for ages. And like as we said, his webcomic, Imurian Tales, is a series very much based in the world of fantasy. So with that in mind, we thought it would be a good time as any to talk about the fantasy genre itself. We haven't really done that on this show. I know. Essentially, we all live in the world of fantasy, don't we, in some ways?
I fantasize a lot.
Right, we're not going there.
We were talking just briefly before the show about like what qualifies as fantasy.
Yeah.
Should we come back to that after Vince has done?
Do you know what?
I think that's a good idea.
I think that's a good starting point. Because with the worlds of like Westeros, Middle Earth, and Hyperborea, have I said that right? The Conan world. I can. That's quite a long name for a fantasy world, isn't it, that one?
But that's only part of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, true. Yeah, but all of those sort of worlds are fully fleshed out to the point of infinitum, and probably lead to fantasy.
Like a nice map with a fantasy.
Oh
story,
yes. Oh god, we love a map here. Yeah. So I would say the genre of fantasy is arguably the biggest blank canvas that a creator can have when it comes to world building and story creation. Wouldn't you agree? I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's getting there, isn't it? Certainly.
But has that opportunity been fully taken advantage of by independent creators and beyond? Plus, here's a question for you. Is there any originality in the genre, or is it all just essentially watered-down copies from earlier works?
Mm. Yeah, does it all stem from sort of Robert E. Howard and Lord of the Rings and stuff like that? Do we adopt certain tropes? I don't think you do, Mark. I've got to tell you. Yours is pretty fresh, dude.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Oh, cheers.
That's all right. Enjoying the conversation there. But I think a lot of people think it's like a noir story, isn't it? Everyone thinks they have to include certain elements.
Yeah.
Would you agree, Mark, or...?
I think when you get any kind of genre fiction, you've got it in your mind what sort of boxes that need ticking almost when you sort of go through it. But I think that to get around that, if you expand your sort of reading, so rather than just like I like one kind of fantasy book, I'm going to keep reading that. Just try a bunch of different ones. Try you know like a mix of things. But I mean, like some of my favorite fantasy stuff's, it's kind of like so one that I'll talk about later on. Is like a kind of noir mystery, but set in this sort of fantasy setting. So it's that kind of mashups were quite interesting. So yeah, I think it's just pulling from different resources. You don't have to go to sort of Tolkien straight off the bat.
I think the thing with it, whatever genre you write within, it's about telling a story in a certain environment, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
You can tell a romance, or you can tell a comedy, or you can tell whatever you like, but it's in a certain kind of world, isn't it? Like a sci-fi or a fantasy or a horror, you know?
Mm.
I think one of the problems for me is that fantasy is not easily... when you say it's a horror story or it's a science fiction story, you've kind of got a certain view, haven't you? But if you say it's a fantasy story, people might say Harry Potter, or some people might say Conan.
With that genre, some people just might completely switch off. It's one of the hardest genres to have that cross-pollination. I mean, obviously, Game of Thrones is massive and it's crossed that border, but I know so many people who watch that show who do not like fantasy, full stop.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
That's one of the things I sort of mentioned to a couple of people I work with, like the fact that they kind of were balk at kind of picking up a book like that, and it's like you're watching a TV show with zombies and dragons, and this is fantasy, and it's kind of... I like that the fact that the kind of the masses are being... kind of getting that, but
I like to think that we've won. That's how I like to think.
You know, slipped under the radar.
Yeah, everyone's like, you know, when people say, "Oh, I don't like fantasy," I watch Coronation Street. I think you watch Game of Thrones. We've beaten you. Yeah. We've won now. Yeah, we've slipped into your consciousness.
Game of Thrones, Walking Dead.
All those Marvel movies. Yeah, you're done. You're one of us now.
We've done you.
Up, we didn't even know.
Do you think though that the fantasy genre is one that nowadays, certainly with creations that you see in comics and stuff, it comes from a more D&D generation rather than the earlier works like you had, like the Conans, etc. You know, these are all these books. You know, Dungeons and Dragons was essentially inspired by the works of, you know, Howard and Tolkien and things like that, wasn't it? But now there's so many fantasy creators and comics that I see who started off as D&D gamers. Do you know what I mean?
I think it's more that sort of subgenre is almost more prevalent in the novels as opposed to comics. Yeah, would I be right in saying that, do you think?
It's a lot more in books, but I definitely think you're on the same there, Vince, with it kind of permeating into comics.
Yeah.
But I think it's heavier in novels, definitely. Mm.
There's sort of these never-ending series of novels that I sort of see on the shelves at Forbidden Planet and stuff, you know.
Fantasy novels scare me. Not in a sense of I'm reading it and being scared, but
see you with the... I'll have to put the light on.
Oh, no!
When it's like a million volumes.
Yeah, and when you start the first book, it's it's basically a doorstop. And if you're not, they're usually a slow burn as well. So if it doesn't get you in the first 20 pages, you know, these things are about 700 pages normally.
I have to write down the names of people because I forget who's who sometimes.
But what do you find that your sort of influences, you know, what fantasy did you like best, Mark, when it came to doing your stuff?
There's a couple of fantasy comics that that I do like, but just with you saying about fantasy novels then and how they're like just these gigantic books and you know, they're kind of hard to get into, I think it totally depends on sort of like the author basically, because I found one of my key things when I'm writing is writing for the characters rather than the story if I can. So I have an idea of the story, but the story usually changes as I develop the character through the book, because I go, well, they wouldn't do that. I know what this character would be thinking now. And that sort of comes from a bit from reading Game of Thrones, because I don't really watch the series anymore, but I've read the books. And it's really sort of character driven. So one of the things that I like about the Game of Thrones books is that there's this really interesting world, but it's given to you in bits and pieces, rather than a Tolkien-esque way where it's,
and it's
like
all first-hand accounts, isn't it? So a lot of the things that happen are stories that someone else has, you know, overheard from something else.
I mean, like from reading George R. R. Martin's stuff, I went on to read Joe Abercrombie's stuff, which is fantastic. And he's got a series of books called the First Law Trilogy, but then he's got a couple of others that are set in the same universe that are standalone, and there's some crossover from characters and stuff, but you don't have to have read the first three books to get into these ones. And the way that he writes characters is just really, really interesting, because they never make the choices that suit a story. They always make the choices that suit themselves, and it usually ends up being horrible for them. So it's it's a pretty grim sort of read. But like I got onto them because on the covers you'd always see like, "This book's awesome," said by George R. R. Martin. And I'm like, all right, so I like George R. R. Martin's work. If he thinks this guy's amazing, then I'll give it a read. And yeah, his stuff's been a big influence in what I've been doing. So I highly recommend it.
That shows the importance of a Paul quote as well.
Yeah. Have you ever read any of the Conan stuff?
I've read a bit of it. What was the one that I got a big collection of them. So it was like,
what, in comic or in book form, dude?
In books,
right?
So
okay.
I read the Becky Cloonan Conan ones, the ones that she drew. But that she only did about 15 issues, I think, and then they started getting in different artists and stuff, and I was kind of following it because it was her rather than, you know, that it was Conan. So I was just really like her artwork, so I followed that. But then book wise I got this collection, and there was the Queen of the I think Queen of the Black Coast was one of the stories in it. There was one that I can't remember the name of, but there was a bit where Conan defeated a guy because his neck was so hench. And it was like, so there was like this huge dude who was like, his thing was strangling people. And so he tried to strangle Conan to death, but because Conan's so ripped, he just tensed. And I think the guy broke his fingers or something. I can't actually remember. But yeah, I've read a few of them. Because like, there's a couple of other authors that were palling around at that time. Like, I think Robert E. Howard knew H.P. Lovecraft and stuff. Yeah. So I've read a bunch of Lovecraft's things. Mm. But from the both of them, like a perfect mix of the two, there's an author called Clark Ashton Smith. And I don't know whether you've heard of him before.
I've heard of the name. I haven't read any of his stuff, though.
Yeah, Clark Ashton Smith. I got onto him because I went to this... there's a gothic sort of seminar that happens each year up in Manchester. And this guy was talking about like these worlds that this Clark Ashton Smith had created. And I was like, oh, it sounds really cool, that. So I managed to find this ratty paperback version on eBay of the book. And it's got the really, you know, like 70s painted cover and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, this is a treasure. And so I was reading it, and I quickly realized that pretty much every story has a bit of corpse bumming in it. So, like,
Hang on a minute. Pardon. Let me write this down.
If
these shows were named after something that was said in an episode, this show would just be called Corpse Bumming.
Yeah.
it was funny because like I started playing a little bit of a game as to is this going to have a corpse that gets bummed in it? So I'd read like the title of the title of one of the stories, and I'd go, maybe. I think like while I was reading it, I was taking some photos of some of the quotes from it, because I was like, I think this is happening. I think this is really about like there's one story which is these two necromancers, these brothers, are wandering this land, because the ones that I've read are all centered in Zothic. And it's like this dying continent. The sun's disappearing and stuff like that. And it's really, you know, it's super prog. Yeah. There's like these two necromancers that are really powerful, and they find this dead kingdom. So it's like there's nothing left there. There's just ruins and bodies. And so they end up they raise the bodies of all these dead people and make them like they build the kingdom again for themselves. And then the kind of like so they've got this army of zombie people, and they've got like them tilling the land and making food. Like it becomes like an economic power and stuff like that. And then these guys, these necromancers, end up getting bored and basically just bumming some corpses for like a large part of the story.
Do you think the author just ran out of ideas and just was like, what can I do now?
I think he was doing it to wind people up. This is like done in the 20s or 30s or something like that. And you can imagine this is the, you know, like ban this sick filth sort of thing. So because he was a pulp writer like Robert E. Howard and H.P. Lovecraft. So his stuff would appear in these sort of like the really short. Some of them don't really have an ending, but yeah, there's like a lot of stuff where there's one where this guy's looking at this dead body of his lover, and he's like, "Ah, she looks really good." And I was like, "Oh, mate, don't go there."
Here we go.
It's like, oh, that's a red flag. So, but his stuff's the corpse woman included. It's really interesting. So he's just like the world that he created, and like this weird little mythology that he put together, and there's like an island of necromancers, and that's where where like any necromancer will come from and stuff. And there's one which is a really petty story about it's like an emperor, and he does something to annoy this super powerful wizard, and so the super powerful wizard magics a castle that's bigger than the emperor's next door to the emperor. That's it. He's when he was young, this emperor had like he'd rode over him on his horse. So this powerful wizard, when he wasn't powerful, he was just this young lad, gets ridden over by this emperor, and the emperor leaves him to die because he doesn't care, because you know he's just like a pauper, and he ends up getting taken in by this sort of wizard and becoming super powerful, and he's like, and I never forgot that I got ridden over by a horse, and so so he just like spends this story just messing with the emperor, like because. He's known as this powerful wizard throughout the land. No one dare say anything. And then when he's got the power that he needs, he builds this giant castle next to the emperor, so it's bigger and like blocks out the sun and everything. And like he sends like a ghost horse. It's like a horse that like you can't see it, but you can hear it. And it basically messes up all his marble floors because it's just stomping on him.
This is basically like a fantasy version, like Neighbours from Hell, isn't it?
Yeah. It just like, and it keeps escalating, and it's just it's really interesting.
I just hope there's an episode of it where he writes like fake sex notes and leaves him with the emperor. Just fucks with his head.
Yeah. Signed S.
Yeah. Now.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So yeah, I do think that it is important to like look at more stuff, because like you know, new ideas and that. So
yeah, the Tolkien's loomed large, hasn't it? Yeah. Essentially.
Yeah. I'm not like I'm not a mega Tolkien fan. I used to be like back in the day. It was one of the first sort of big fantasy books that I read. But
I think all the geeks read the books, didn't they? I think you didn't feel part of geekdom back in the day if you hadn't sort of ploughed through them. And some of them get a little bit hard going at points.
God, yeah.
You know? Yeah, The Hobbit's written in a way that's like accessible, but Lord of the Rings is kind of, for me, it was fairly tedious.
That's why I was always more Robert E. Howard fan. Because like you say, they were written for pulps. There was short, punchy. Yeah. And there's not actually that many of them. You can go to the Elsprague de Camp stuff and all that sort of thing. You know, where people have taken it on board. And I got to it through the comics, which I mean, the Marvel's Conan, Red Sonja, Solomon Kane, Kull type stuff is fucking superb.
Were those sort of like adaptions or anything, or is it like all Some fresh? Oh, really?
Yeah, they dropped adaptions in here and there. Yeah, there's even a crossover with Elric in one of the earlier issues as well.
Oh, right.
Really?
Yeah, which is quite interesting.
I was reading that some of the writers from the comic were brought on to write the second Conan film, Conan the Destroyer.
I think you're right. Yeah,
because they were saying that the first, I really enjoyed the first Conan film, but the audience wanted a more fantastic version.
Mm. It becomes an Italian schlock. The first one sets a tone for a lot of people who basically aped it in Italian sort of science fiction and fantasy movies. And then the second Conan movie becomes what it was aped almost, doesn't it?
Yeah. I really like the realism of the first film, but it's weird as well, that's supposed to be really violent back in the day, but you look at it now and it's like, you've probably seen some of this stuff on TV.
Yeah.
Yeah. I watched some of the new one today.
With Jason Momoa.
Yeah, it's a hard going one.
I'll tell you what, the only time when it's good is when he's a kid. The first 5 minutes, that bit when he's the kid. And then
I've probably watched 10 minutes and he's still a kid.
Yeah. It gets worse after that.
The editing for it's really weird because it's edited like a comedy movie. There's a bit where it just smash cuts to this guy pulling someone's fingernails out or something like that, like this torture scene. And like the juxtaposition with the scene before it, it's like it's like a comedy beat. It's so weird.
Yeah,
that's a strange one.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, have you read any of the Buscema, Roy Thomas, Ernie Chan stuff, Mark? Have you? Or
no, I'm a bit of a philistine, really. I'm not really.
Oh, we all are.
Yeah. like old comics wise, there's not like a mega load that I've read, to be honest. Right. Like,
I've got to tell you, mate, if you want to go to, I mean, because Conan 1 starts the Bronze Age, is the way it works, but If you get to the Buscema stuff, people talk about, you know, liking consistent comics, you know, with the same art team, same writer. Yeah. And you can't beat Conan for that. It goes on for donkey's years and it's all class and it's all very readable now. I read King Conan. I read the first few issues of that yesterday on the train, and it's class stuff, still really readable. I highly recommend it, you know.
Oh, cool.
And you can pick it up for peanuts, I think, now.
Yeah.
Are they all like single issue sort of stories?
Not all of them. Yeah, not all of them. Some of them are, you know, some of them. And that was how it was. Comics were back then, you know. And then if you get into some of the Tim Truman stuff later on with Dark Horse, that's really good as well. Mm. And you can get these Savage Sword of Conan, like phone directories.
I've seen them, yeah.
Yeah, you can pick them up for a tenner. And they're, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pages long. And they were magazine length stories. So they were 40 or 50 pages, some of the stories, you know. But absolute, just class, you know, you could put that out as a comic now and people would buy it and not know the difference, you know.
Yeah.
It's all class art as well. Very good.
Is Conan, is that a license that's owned by someone, or is that one of those?
No, I think it's owned.
It's owned.
Yeah, it's now Dark Horse, yeah. Because Dark Horse, strangely, are putting out the Marvel stories.
Okay.
So must be some kind of deal with that. Yeah.
Oh.
It's
one of those characters that never really slipped into the public domain.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
Is it after a certain time, or if you don't keep up making stories? I can't remember. I really can't recall what the ruling or the law is on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is it 100 years or something? Isn't it?
Or
75 years or something like that.
Oh, is it? Yeah.
Yeah, it might be. Please let us
Poor
know
old Paul
what
McCartney,
it is.
Eh?
Paul McCartney.
But, he's 83, isn't he? Yeah.
Is he?
I don't know, whatever he is. His song's got to be coming up soon. Yeah. Anyway, back to Conan. But I mean, Red Sonja is owned by a different company. Isn't Red Sonja put out by someone else now?
Dynamite, isn't it?
Dynamite.
Yeah.
Mm.
Which is a strange one. When you think that they, you know, they in comics-wise, they appeared together in the first comic.
I think when it comes to a lot of comics, it's the fantasy characters that most people remember rather than the fantasy story, don't you think?
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, that could be unfair. Very iconic, that, aren't yeah, they? That's very yeah. unfair to a lot of stories. I mean, I'll hold my hand up. There's probably a million things that I haven't read that I really should have.
There's certain things, like you remember Conan the Barbarian from Sumeria, don't you? And then you remember Kull is obviously a king of Atlantis. You know, there's a few things that you remember, aren't there? But it's very sort of iconic setting character-wise, isn't it? You know?
One thing for artists working on a fantasy comic, that can be quite challenging because you're going to have to take reference heavily, obviously, for kind of armor, swords, unless you just kind of make it off the top of your head. But essentially also you're drawing a lot of horses.
Yeah.
And if armies are involved.
And tigers and, got, and shit yeah, like
it's
that.
Like,
yeah.
Jesus Christ, I mean, you're kind of
Mark,
pushed.
In both volumes of the Ymirian Tales, you've got big ornate suits of armor and actions and swords going all over the shop. Did you ever think at one point, oh God, what have I done?
Yes.
When it came to character design.
In the Waterbringer, I got tired of drawing his pauldron, his big shoulder piece, because I was like, I drew out the initial sketch and I was like, oh yeah, that looks sick. And then I started drawing it and I was like, this is an absolute nightmare from any angle that I try and do it. It is
it's
a
like
pain
Dread's
to draw.
Eagle, isn't it? It's similar.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah.
So I ended up, that's why it gets smashed.
Yeah, nice one.
So I was like, in the fight that he has, like in the middle of the book, I was like, yeah, I'm going to mess that pauldron up and then I don't have to draw it anymore.
I did that with one of my characters in the first bit of the issue. He gets like the symbol blown off his chest because I'm not fucking drawing that the rest of the issue.
I love these little shortcuts Lazy. That people make. Yeah. Yeah. But you wouldn't know. People wouldn't know other than, you know, the fact that you've just revealed it then. But then
yeah, should've kept my mouth shut.
Yeah. But he's lost his shoulder guard and but then in the end of that you've got like a massive villain. That is yet another sort of suit of armor and chainmail and stuff. Did you designed him after the Waterbringer? I'm guessing.
The Manticore champion guy.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes, I did. Yeah, yeah.
So, did you have that in mind after the shoulder pads and stuff? Did you think, right, I'm going to try and make life easier for myself?
I'm trying to think when, because I think I designed him before I started drawing the book.
Yeah.
I was like, one of the artists that I mentioned later on, I was looking at how he sort of draws people, and I was trying to emulate that with the armor that he was wearing, because like the Waterbringers is like very much like, you know, coming out of the silhouette and stuff like that, whereas this artist that I like, he's within the silhouette. And so I kind of was going for that with the champion, but that was I've got my process for armor is generally like I just base it off heraldry, so it's like a it's like, you know, Clegane's armor. He's got like the hound helmet and he's got the standard that's got the three dogs on it and stuff like that. So that's how it ended up being like a kind of weird manticore thing, because I was like, right, I'm going to have to design this environment, this sort of place, and I'm going to have to design the people, like the guards that are within it, and this champion dude. And so I was like, right, I'll choose a heraldic sort of animal. I'll just base everything off that. So I chose a manticore. So the clothes that the king and queen and the princess wear, I've got like little scorpion tails in and stuff like that, and sort of bat wings and things, and lion faces and stuff. And then the environment itself, whenever I was like, oh, I don't know what I'm doing, it's like, oh, mate, this look like a scorpion tail, or this can look like, you know, this archway can look like some wings and stuff like that. And then the armor of the guards and the so the guards have got like this sort of short bat-like cape, and I made the sort of covering so on the helmet. That if I remember correctly, because like I don't look at my stuff like all the time, but I think the visors of the sort of helmets look like bat wings, yes. And then there's like spiked motif going down the sort of leather the leather bit of the armor that comes down to cover the neck and stuff. So yeah, I just like got the one idea and I just wouldn't let go of it. So that's
I got a bit of an Excalibur vibe, you know, the movie Excalibur. Is that an influence from you?
No.
I was going to say Silver Samurai, but I doubt that is either, if you've seen that character.
I've seen him, but no, it's not an influence.
You draw a badass Silver Samurai, though. You draw an amazing. Yeah.
But my whole thing with like the designs and stuff is that I'm really into history. So, my job outside of doing comics and illustration stuff, I'm a lecturer. And that one of the things that I try and get people to do is like decent research into stuff, because I always found that when I was designing, whenever I design things, I'm like, does it work? Would it work? And it annoys me if it doesn't, because it feels like a little puzzle that I need to solve. And so it's like, I when it comes to armor, I don't look at pictures of armor necessarily. I look at diagrams of how armor is put together. So, you know, what each of the individual parts are, why they're like that. One of the field trips that I did with my students was I took them to the Royal Armouries, and we got to see, like, you know, some armor up close and stuff. And one of the students got to like put on his put on the armor, and so you saw all the different layers and how it all clicked together and stuff like that. And so that sort of influences the way that I create things. So there's like a simple idea, and then there's like a functional idea. So the simple idea when it comes to designing stuff with Murrian Tales is what is the heraldry, what is the symbol of that organization or that monarchy or whatever it is, and how can I bring that into something that is might be functional. So
yeah, and it also that leads me to talk about world building, because I think with most great fantasy stories, there's a massive world that no one will ever read about or see, or, you know, the maps and the creatures and the stories and characters and stuff. So before you even started your first Imurian Tales story, did you spend a long time creating this vast world for it all to exist in?
No.
It's a great interview. It's not going well.
Yeah, I'm coming at you from a different angle. I kind of don't like all that stuff. Like, I like worlds, but then the problem is that if you spend so long writing the world, then you don't have anything interesting to put in it. So, like, one of the reasons that I really like Abercrombie's stuff is that he's got this really interesting world, but it's told to you through the story rather than someone sitting you down and telling you, you know, this is the history of this world. So you find stuff out organically. Characters don't necessarily talk about stuff that's obvious to them. Mm. And that was one of the main things that I wanted to have, was that his stuff is character-driven fantasy.
Yeah.
So it's not about the world, it's about the people within it. And I think that one of the reasons Game of Thrones is really successful is not because, I mean, who cares about Westeros, you know?
Well, a lot of people, if you
no,
watch
no,
YouTube.
It's yeah. Whatever. It's kind of whatever, but what makes that show interesting is the characters.
Yeah, what
you know?
Has invested people is those characters, isn't it?
Yeah. And so that's there could be no dragons, and there could be, you know, like a totally different sort of setting, but with those characters, I think people would still tune in, because it's not the world that they're interested in, it's the characters. Yeah. So,
well, I have to admit, that's one of the reasons I stopped watching it, is I just found that you wouldn't see a character from year to year sometimes. I'm a fantasy fan, you know, not as much as some things, and I read a lot of fantasy, but I just watched it and I thought, well, what's happened to that person? Isn't there one famous story about one of the kids who disappears for a whole series or something? Isn't there?
Yeah, it's rough when, like, this is the reason that I stopped watching the show, was because in the books it makes a lot of sense, because you are always from someone's point of view.
Dan said this before, yeah. Yeah,
okay. You're always from someone's point of view, and it can misdirect you really easily, because you are just finding out the information from, like that character possesses. They don't have... a meta sort of understanding of stuff. So, like, when you have like the bit, I'm forgetting the characters' names now. Bran and Rickon, where it looks like they've been killed in like season two or whatever it is,
right?
And it's really badly done in the series, because it's like, oh, quickly we'll bring them back. But in the book, that happens like midway through the book, and then you've got another like 300 pages or something to read, so you actually think that they are gone.
Okay.
It doesn't let you know anything until right at the end, and you just get what the characters are seeing. So there's one bit in it where the thing that made me stop watching, this is like super stupid and very, very like sort of particular of me.
Yeah.
But one of my favorite characters is now I'm forgetting his name. He's the old guard that is with Daenerys. Not Mormont.
Barristan Selmy.
Yes, Barristan Selmy. Yeah, in the books he's Nails. He's amazing.
Yeah.
And he sticks around, like he's still alive in the books. And his whole thing where it was like a because it can only work in like in like a written medium, because you don't know what the character looks like. You just go off what people are saying.
And everyone was saying that he's like the. Just the hardest man in the world.
Yeah, it's when he goes to Daenerys and joins her.
Spoilers.
You don't know that it's him in the book.
Yeah.
For like an entire novel, because it's just like it's a different character, and he's gone like incognito basically, and so it's a big reveal. But they can't do that in the show, so he just had to sort of show up and go, "Hi, I'm here."
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. The actor wants his name in the credits, doesn't he? Probably.
Yeah, because it's hard to. You know what he looks like.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Show, so. It's difficult to. You can't fool an audience with a visual sort of medium. That's why he only works sort of in the book. But he's still kicking around in the books, and he's amazing. But he got killed off like kind of needlessly in the show, and I was like, oh, it's a bit of an easy character to get rid of. You know, he's like, it's some old dude. Yeah, we don't care about him. Let's get some pretty people involved and stuff, and I'm like, I'm kind of done with this now. So because I think he's a really interesting character in the book. So.
Go on, you go for it.
I was going to say I do like the way the TV series hooked you in with a bit of soft porn as well.
Yeah. Essentially, when you got exposition scenes in the early ones, they have like sex going on.
Yeah.
Yes. Kind of there you go. People. Sex is on both our minds, Dan. I knew that happened.
Why am I not surprised?
So when they talk about some plans, it's like usually why they're boffing someone.
Boffing.
There's that bit with Peter Baelish, isn't there, where he's talking to someone, and then there's like there's two of his like ladies that, because he owns a brothel, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And they're just like going at it while he's talking about his plans, and then he stops and goes, "Finger her arse a bit," or something like that. Yeah. It's like, this is super needless.
Did you ever watch Deadwood? Where the main character was always getting a blowjob whilst he was like ranting about who he wanted to kill and what he wanted to do. That was class. Yeah,
it's strange because one of the things is like with the fantasy is like you do have like where you self-mark, you haven't built up such a big backstory, but there's others that are just a massive amount of world building, and I feel like. Is that needed as long as the story works?
Yeah, that's
puts
me off a bit sometimes.
Yeah, if it's assisting the story, that's fine. But otherwise, it's kind of like, why do you need all this?
Yeah, I mean, I've been looking into this a little bit, because when I first started, I was like, so I like more organic ways of finding out about places. So like I'm a big Dark Souls fan, and when you're playing that, it doesn't sit you down and go, so this is what's happening. You just kind of you kind of have a guess at it, basically. You put the pieces together by the places that you're going and the things that you're seeing. And so there's like that and Bloodborne have got really nice sort of visual storytelling. You know, you can put things together by the things that you are seeing, rather than it just sitting you down and explaining everything to you. Sorry.
I was going to say, like Lord of the Rings, if the people haven't read the books, essentially that's like a history lesson on Middle-earth.
Yeah, this is why...
Very much like that.
Yeah, it's why I wasn't very interested, because like I keep getting people ask me, so what is the Waterbringer? And I was like, that's not the point of it, you know. Yeah. I have a mythology for the Waterbringers, because I intend to use like different Waterbringers in different stories, but it's not really the point of what Waterbringers?
It's just a vehicle for the story, and like it's the story that counts, not just this.
Yeah, yeah. It's like I had to stop myself when I was doing the fight with the champion, because I was gonna have it that the Waterbringers like armor, right? And I didn't find a spot to actually go into this in the story, but it's got water in it. You can control water, and it's like a little bladder. Sort of suit, almost, and he can manipulate. So that's why he can end up taking a lot of damage, is because he can manipulate the water that's within this sort of bladder that's in the suit. And then I was like, I started writing that in as a thing, like, oh no, you know, he's got this suit that does this and he can control it. And I was like, this sounds lame as hell, you know. I was like, it's just me trying to sit people down and explain stuff to them rather than having something interesting happen. So I just scrapped it all. The amount of stuff that I put in, which is exposition, and then just go, that sounds hokey, and then just get rid of it.
But because, to be fair, in the first comic is like a kind of a breakout, the two characters, and like it's all action. There wouldn't be that time to kind of sit down and have exposition. So I just presume that would come later.
Yeah. I mean, like, I kind of wanted to do Amurian Tales as a way of me being able to tell whatever story I felt like. So there is, I do have a story for the world, but it's not like a super involved one. It's really loose. Yeah. It's like a really sort of vague mythology that I've got. And then like with the Waterbringers, like when people are asking me what is he, it's like a Waterbringer is like a D&D class is my idea. It's like a paladin. It's like a, you know, a barbarian. It's whatever. It's just they're a class basically that you would find in fantasy. So
they're also badass. I mean, it's a character that I just thought, God, this is awesome. You immediately like him just because he's there. He is literally the strong silent type, isn't he? That just absolutely kicks ass.
Yeah. It was funny, sort of, because like when I was first writing it, he spoke and he did loads of other stuff, and like the more that I was sort of planning it out, I was like, I don't like this, you know, because for me the Waterbringer isn't about the Waterbringer; it's about the princess.
Yeah,
She's the main character, and he's like the tool for her to be able to escape, basically. So he's her bodyguard. And my initial writing of it, that wasn't the case. It was like it just didn't feel right. And the more that I wrote the princess, the more I liked her, and the more I wanted her to be like. But I kind of wanted it to be realistic as well. I didn't want it to be like, you know, being able to do loads of badass stuff when she's just like she's like a young girl who's lived in this sort of palace. So you know, I wanted it to be her agency, but enacted through him, basically. So yeah, it changed a bunch as I was writing it. So.
He does have some absolutely badass moments. One of my favourites is when he reaches up, he basically forces his fist through someone's throat and then through their face mask.
Oh, yeah.
You do good action, dude.
As I said, the action is absolutely fantastic. Yeah.
And you start on an action moment as well, don't you, in Amurian Tales? You start on that violent sharpness, don't you, almost?
Yeah, on the Waterbringer I did, yeah.
There's a big stabbing moment. I don't want to ruin it for anyone, but
yeah, I mean, it's the first five pages, so it's not too much of a spoiler. But I read like a bunch of like manga as well as like you know, Western comics, and one of my big influences for drawing action is One Piece, because when I started reading that. Way back when I was like 17 or whatever, I was reading it and I'm like, oh, the way that this is drawn, it's really visceral. It feels like things are happening, and it didn't feel static. It felt like there was a lot of movement in the images. So there's lots of curves and, you know, things are over exaggerated and stuff like that. And so I kind of I go for that kind of thing. But as well, I'm interested in history. I'm interested in sort of like. Like boxing and combat stuff. So when I'm choreographing, I choreograph a fight and try and think, well, does it make sense that this is how it's working rather than, you know, just doing whatever. So
okay,
but because the first story was so action packed, was it your definite choice to do something that is a lot? I mean, there's action in The Shattered, but it's definitely more of a character and emotional arc, isn't it? That one. Was that you literally going, right, I want to try doing something else now?
No.
Every question.
Oh, God.
what happened was, I ended up doing an entirely different process when I was writing The Shattered. Because when I did The Waterbringer, I made it up as I went along. So I had two sides of A4, which was like story points that I wanted to hit. It's kind of going for like the Jackie Chan school of like movie writing, where he's like, I want to have this action scene, this action scene, and this action scene, then I'll string the rest of it together, whatever. I did that for The Waterbringer, so I was writing it like 5 pages at a time. It was kind of fun. I had to make sure that I didn't write myself into any corners or anything like that. And I ended up like changing a couple of bits and pieces, like once I was printing it. But I tried to do that again, and it was really difficult on a more complex story. So I don't know whether you saw, like, not long after The Waterbringer had come out, I released a promotional image for The Word Wielder, which was going to be the next story, and it was going to focus on this sort of Inquisition force that works for the Church. And I had like the idea for it, and I tried to do it the same way that I did the Waterbringer, and I just couldn't do it. I must have drawn the first 10 pages over like 3 times. I was chopping and changing stuff, and it was a really reductive way of work. It just didn't work for me at all. And so I was like, right, I've soured on this story that I want to do, which was going to have more like a bit of a Wicker Man sort of vibe to it.
Nice.
But I soured on that, and so I was like, right, let's have a look at what other stories I've got, because I keep like a Google Doc like folder where I'll write up I'll be out and about, and I'll go, oh, that could be a cool idea. I'll write it up on my phone quickly, and then I'll just leave it, and then
that's
come
exactly
back to it.
That's exactly how Dan works, isn't it, Dan?
Yeah, exactly.
It's just really useful, you know, the amount of times.
Forgettable people as well.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Like the amount of times where I've thought of a story idea while I'm walking, and then I'm like, yeah, that's really cool, that. And then I'll get back home, and I'll be like, oh, what was it?
Where the fuck was
yeah,
it?
I'm like, all the time, yeah.
Yeah, so I end up like, I've got Google Docs on my phone, I'll type it up there, or if I'm at work and then I get an idea, I can quickly type it up on the computer there and stuff. So yeah, I ended up trawling through them, and I found one that was... It was a framework that I ended up building off, because, like I said before, the Shattered changed as the characters were sort of written, basically. So I was figuring out more and more about how the story should go, because I was having the characters react to things in certain ways. So I think the best example of that is Saramak, the lore eater. He was originally going to be like a Gandalf sort of character. Rolls into town, great big bushy beard, you know, he's a lovely old man, and he was going to be like, you know, Marwyn's, you know, wish you could be my dad sort of thing. And then when I started, I had to have him do some, I try to avoid doing too much exposition, because I think it bogs down the story. It feels really unnatural when people speak in it. And it was very unnatural when I was putting in the speech bubbles for this kindly old gent. I was like, this guy sounds like an arse. He sounds like a right know-it-all. And that changed the character entirely. So I redesigned him to be a know-it-all, and so and to be like a smug dude. So
yeah, he's got that sort of attitude, hasn't he? He's quite funny as well. He's sort of
That was kind of completely different character from when I started. So
and visually, like he looks like he's walked straight in from The Witcher, or you know, rather than that Gandalf sort of look, he's got a sleeker sort of look, hasn't he?
Yeah, I was again like his this isn't really again said in the story, but like he's part of an order that seek knowledge. I think I was watching. I think it was an episode of Cosmos with Neil deGrasse Tyson,
where
he was
on about.
You. See, it's not that fancy. It's produced by the guy that made Family Guy. So, but yeah, like I was watching that, and he was mentioning in the Middle East there used to be like people that would go out to different parts of the world and sort of just learn about them. And then bring back the knowledge and stuff. So you'd have these like moving libraries and stuff like that that'd collect information and bring it all back to the Middle East. I think that that's the idea in the 13th Warrior. I think
that, okay, like, yeah.
Right, okay.
I like that film. I know.
I think it's a fun film. But I think Omar Sharif's character is supposed to be like one of those people. He's supposed to go out and find stuff, and then Antonio Banderas is like his ward or whatever, and then he ends up joining him, doesn't he? So, so that's the idea that I had for his. I wanted to have an organization like that in my world, and then I was sort of sat there going like, right, well, I need this symbol, I need this iconography for him. What can it be? And so I'm there doodling ideas and like, what are some symbols for knowledge and stuff? And I was just like, you know, it just wasn't going anywhere really. And then I chose fire. It's like, you know, flame of knowledge sort of thing. And so the symbol that's like, I did like a sort of symbol which is three points with a circle in the middle, and then like a down point, looks a little like a shield, but that's supposed to be like a graphical fire, basically. And then you have that as in the outfit on with the hat that he's wearing. It's called a chaperon. So it's like a hood that could be worn in loads of different ways. So you see it. You'll be getting Witcher vibes because Roach in The Witcher wears a chaperon. And I was like, because I remember looking at that and I was going, oh, I like it. He's wearing like a turban or something, but it's not. It's a hood that's rolled up weird. That's just like a normal sort of peasant's hood.
Yeah.
But it looks really fancy. And then people started making them specifically to be like that, and they got bigger and crazier. And so I was like, right, well, if they have a chaperon, then I can, depending on how the character is. Depends on how he wears it. So if they're a bit moody, then maybe they'll just have it as a hood. If they're like flashy, like Saramak is, then you know he's rolled it up into like the big fancy sort of hat version.
It really feels like your fantasy world is evolving and becoming something. It's almost expanding with every story and every character design that you're coming up with, isn't it? Really, it is the characters who are creating this world in a sense.
Yeah, it's I'm winging it definitely. because like I found that like the more that I looked back at this lore idea that I had, the less interesting that became, like all the lore stuff. So I'm like, yeah. I'm trying not to tie myself down to it too much. In the lore stuff though, there was the mention of the Shadir and stuff like that, which is why I wanted to introduce them in a story. But I didn't want to do like a big battle or anything like that. Yeah. I just wanted that'd be like a small moment, and that's what I kind of want each of the stories to be. It's a moment rather than, this isn't the first story in like, you know, these two characters' adventures, and then you're going to go back and you like, I'm going to go back to them and write another one. So like, I still don't know whether I'm going to return to the princess, for example, from the Waterbring. I really like her as a character, but I don't know whether I'm going to. I just kind of think, well, I could just tell a different story with a different character, and you know, so there's possibilities to bring people back, but I'm not planning it like that.
I think if I was to do like a fantasy story, and I've got concepts for some in my head, but I think I definitely have to wing it, like you, because otherwise you just spend so much time trying
to
create the world.
You get bogged down with it, don't you?
Yeah, that's what I think. As long as it doesn't impede the story.
Yeah. It's like fast-forwarding through the opening of Game of Thrones. It just bores me now. I don't want to see that map. Get on with it.
Yeah.
I mean, some in things made up.
Yeah.
I think it's you suffer if you're coming up with something like fantasy-based or just like any sort of creative endeavor, really. I don't know whether you get this, Dan, but like, you can spend so much time thinking about it that you never get anything done with it.
Yeah.
You know, you can just keep writing and coming up with stuff, and it's like
J.R.R. Martin, for example.
So that was one thing that I was very conscious of, was that I didn't want to spend like, you know, a year writing characters and settings. And like, I see people do this online as well, where it's like, oh, I've got this great idea, and then they'll do like fan images of their own stuff, and it's like the characters just piling around. I'm like, this looks really cool. Why aren't you making it, you know?
Yeah.
And I didn't want to get into that sort of thing, so that's why I kept it fairly loose.
But you're right, that applies to anything.
There's tons of that.
Yeah.
It's the magnum opus syndrome, isn't it? It's like, oh, this is this idea that I've had since I was 16. I haven't had this idea since I was 16. I had it like 2 years ago or whatever, when I just decided that I wanted to do some fantasy stuff. And I try and avoid dipping back into like, you know, these sort of beloved ideas that I had when I was, you know, like a teenager. Because for me, like, I can look at them now and go, these suck. So I didn't know what I was.
It's a case of just do it, mate. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Stop talking about it. Just get on with it. You know, yeah. And when you start doing it, you'll actually find your feet with it. You know, sometimes. You know.
Yeah.
So because you have you're literally winging it, as you say, and when people come up to your table, etc., they ask these questions that you might not have the answers to. What sort of questions would you like people to ask about their series when they come to the table?
Oh, God, I don't know.
You want to be careful because we might get our listeners to ask a question next time.
Can I get you a bottle of water? You look thirsty. That's one of my favourite ones.
Never heard that one.
No, I'd like to hear it. Yeah.
I don't know. I think it's boggling people's minds a little bit when they come over to the table and they like one of the books and then they realise that I'm not going to return to those characters ever. And I think they kind of go like, oh, but they're used to having
tell
a continuous
them that,
thing. So yeah, I do, yeah. Hmm. I was like, oh, I'm done with that. Next one. Because what I want these to be is, like I say, I want them to be moments. And having seen the struggle that people can have, like especially indie press-wise, of having the time to put together like a big series because it's such a commitment. Mm. And then you do your 30 pages and it takes you like, you know, a couple of months to put together. Then you do your print run and then you go to the conventions. And then if someone likes it, then they've got to wait until, you know, the next convention or they've got to try and find, like, you know, they're hooked into a series then, which is hard for them to access. I suppose when you're talking about how Comic House is working, that might negate that, you know, it might fix that problem. But for me, I was like, look, selfishly, I'd probably get bored if I was writing a really long series because I get fatigued on stuff fairly quickly. And, you know, I like the idea that you can read any of them, any of the books that I'm going to do, any of the stories that I'm going to tell, you can read any of them and it'll be an experience in and of itself that you don't need to have read all the other ones.
Yeah.
But if you read them all, then you're going to get an idea of how the world's sort of built. So the world building is over all the stories, but each story is a character-driven one. So,
yeah, nice. Let's drop in a cheeky little listener question then.
Yeah.
Now, Umar Ditter, I hope I said that right. I believe I have. He's a creator in his own right. He said, do you find it at all challenging telling your story via a fantasy setting, or was that the plan from the get-go?
It was the plan from the get-go, really. Amorian Tales was me going, I want to write some fantasy. So it wasn't like a story that I wanted to tell, and then I was like, oh, I'll do it through the medium of fantasy. So yeah, it was just a straight-up thing. I think it's weird as when I look at the stuff that people pick up on ideas that are within the books that I didn't put in there originally because I was just writing something, and then these ideas sort of manifest like subconsciously for me. So they all end up like both of the stories have ended up being about something,
yeah,
without me really realizing that what it was about when I started it. So
is there still a big audience for fantasy? Maybe Game of Thrones has kind of reinvigorated, but I certainly feel there was a bit of kind of, after Lord of the Rings, there was a bit of fatigue about it. It was like, oh, what else can be done to this? And it had to be left for a bit before it kind of could be used again, as it were.
Yeah, the main comics companies don't dip their toes in it quite so much, do they?
No.
You know, it used to be they'd all have something going on, like they'd have Conan or Warlord or something like that going on, but it doesn't seem to be as prevalent these days.
No.
Marvel certainly doesn't touch it as much as they used to, do they?
Yeah, we had a bit of weird world, didn't we? And that sort of stopped. And yeah, a few things here and there. That weird world was very good, but yeah, it's a strange one, isn't it? It's a strange trope at the moment, yeah. What do you think, Mark?
Yeah, I'm... Sorry, I just blanked on the question. I was just listening to what you were saying. I totally forgot the question.
Essentially saying, like, when we had Lord of the Rings, it kind of felt like there was a bit of fatigue on fantasy, and now kind of Game of Thrones is back in the spotlight. Would you say that the audience is more kind of open for fantasy and sword and sorcery stories?
Maybe. I don't know. Like, I think people that come over to my table kind of they get what I'm selling, because you know it's dark, big dark banner with you know, like a weird picture of me on it, and there's like, you know, standing prints of like mythological creatures and stuff like that, and it's all got like a metal vibe to it. So when people come over to the table, I think it's that kind of darkness that's bringing them in initially, and then I go like, oh well, it's a dark fantasy, and they're like, oh okay then. Rather than it being specifically people coming over because they see that it's a fantasy one.
Ah,
book.
Gotcha.
Ah, interesting.
So yeah, I always rub my hands together when I see someone that's like, you know, wearing like a heavy metal t-shirt, or you know, looks like they're into Wiccan stuff. I'm like, come on over here. You know, you want to see this.
Want the goth pound.
Yeah, yeah.
I see one of the Fantasy World's friend of the show, Pat Mills, with Slain.
Yeah.
That really comes alive with the research, as we mentioned earlier. It brings so much to life of the story. And he mentioned himself that, like, bits have kind of almost written themselves when he's kind of done a bit of research or reading up on the period. And that feels a very rich fantasy environment that's not kind of, well, it's not got so much of the kind of the monsters, and it's more real, as it were.
I mean, to me, he's almost setting, there's almost subgenres, isn't there, to fantasy, and that's almost, he's creating a legend, you know. It's like a legendary character. I'd probably put someone like Elric in the same sort of bag as well.
I think Slain's based off of a lot of actual mythology, isn't he? Like, because like the Horned God was a mythological figure, and is he supposed to be based off like Cuchulainn or something? Or
the Tain, stuff like that.
No, definitely. Do you want to play a little game?
Oh god.
Okay. Right. This is the "Do we consider this fantasy or not fantasy?" I've got a list of a number of comics. Does it fit into our very geeky?
You'll say them, and the three of us will just say yes or no.
Okay. Right. The first one is probably one of the most popular in fantasy stories. You know, in a wide sense, fantasy stories out there. Adventure Time.
God.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a hard one.
Hard one, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Here's another one. Wonder Woman.
No.
Okay. Even though that's where the line is drawn. We've got to draw a line, haven't we? It's got a fantasy element to it.
It's got a fantasy element to it, but it's crossed more into the superhero genre.
Yeah, okay.
I probably agree with you on that one. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. How about Solomon Kane?
Fantasy. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to say horror on that one.
No.
Yeah.
I've made that noise a couple of times this week. I don't know what's wrong though.
It's getting me going.
It definitely straddles both.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Okay. Here's another one. John Carter.
No.
Yeah. Sci-fi. No.
Sci-fi.
Yeah, I'd say it's sci-fi. Or like, if I wanted to be picky, I'd say like sci-fantasy sort of thing.
Yeah.
Okay. How about this one? Hellboy.
No.
No.
No. Just folklore and legends, maybe more than...
Yeah.
Is that a different area, do you think?
Yeah, probably.
Supernatural
more
kind of...
Stepping more into the horror slash hero sort of
thing. Thorgal. Have you read that yet, by the way, Vince?
I haven't.
Yeah,
I haven't. But from looking through it, I would say yes.
Okay. Cerebus.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep, I'd say that as well. Just done stylish, isn't it? It's just got a style about it.
Yeah.
It's almost a character in itself, isn't it? Here's a weird one. The Fables universe.
No.
Okay. Why so, Mark?
I don't see it like I mean, to be fair, I haven't read a lot of Fables. Like my main experience with it has been the really good Wolf Among Us video game that they had. But that's kind of what I see it as. It's like it's more a noir story, is that, I'd say, more like a detective story. And I get that kind of sort of thing with it as a whole, because they're all sort of living in New York. It's not a fantasy story.
Yeah, there's elements where they're not, though. Do you know what I mean? They do travel between realms, but I think it's more of a sort of fairy tale. Is there a distinction between a sort of grounded fairy tale? You know, it's like funny one, isn't it?
I think it's the modern setting that takes me out of it, and I would that's what makes me say no.
Okay. Here's another one, the Porcelain series.
Yeah. I struggle to think of any other one it slots into.
Yeah, even though they're kind of robots, aren't they? Kind of.
Yeah.
In a sense, but I think the fantasy genre, although I think like a modern like city sort of setting, like if you're putting it in New York, that would take me out of it. But if you're creating, if you're creating cities and palaces, and you know there is, you know, magic or civil wars or anything going on, that for me steps more into the fantasy genre.
Okay. In Porcelain, the first one's a bit more fairy tale esque.
Yeah.
The second one a lot more serious.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, definitely. It's more sort of grim fairy tales type.
Yeah.
Okay, how about this one? Camelot 3000.
Oh. No.
No?
I haven't read it.
I haven't read it.
What's wrong with you two?
I've only got a passing knowledge of it, I have to say.
Arthurian, not fantasy?
Yeah. I don't know.
It's weird how we have this image, don't we, of our heads, you know?
Yeah.
Because I think because we're sort of part, well, I certainly am, of the Dungeons and Dragons, you know, age group, where, you know, that was very much what people saw as fantasy, wasn't it? You know?
Yeah.
When I was looking through the books that I was wanting to talk about, recommend, or bring up, I was sort of like, is this class as fantasy? I got a couple of, like, I don't know whether it is. To sort of run by yourself,
and we shouldn't have to sort of classify it. Really, it's just a bit of fun, isn't it? Really,
A lot of that stuff I did the class is sword and sorcery. That kind of like barbarians and elves battling orcs or whatever. Kind of fantasy seems to kind of it's more of a catch-all term.
We spoke before we recorded, didn't we? We mentioned the wicked and divine, and I would say categorically no. But there are lots of fantastical...
A lot of our listeners seem to think it is, don't they?
A lot of fantastical elements to it.
Mm. Yeah, but if you take Matt Wagner's The Demon, if you ignore the current sort of proliferation of the character, was a magical creature in an Arthurian land, I would probably put that one as fantasy. It's weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, a couple more. Right, a couple more. Let's see. Bone.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Fantasy.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. ElfQuest.
Yeah.
Okay. Lady Death.
Oh God. I'd say no. I perceive it more as a superhero title or a horror title as opposed to a fantasy.
Yeah, I'd go with Dan on that. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Gru the Wanderer.
Yeah. Fantasy.
Yeah. Okay. The Unwritten by Mike Carey.
I don't know that one.
I'd say no, just off of what I've read. I've only read like the first couple of volumes of it.
I haven't read enough. Fantasy. Yeah, but from what I've seen, no.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I agree with you on that one. It's more sort of Harry Potter esque, isn't it? It's not. It's not a rip, but it's a homage to certain areas of it too, aren't they?
Yeah.
Here's a weird one I wrote down: Planet Hulk.
Oh.
No.
I don't know. Yeah. I've got more of a Spartacus kind of thing from that one, if anything.
Yeah. Okay.
But, I love that series, but
it's really good. Pretty good series.
Yeah.
Yeah. Both of them are good. Yeah. And then when they return to it, really good. Yeah.
Yeah. You're loving this, aren't you, Tony? You can see us squirming, can't you?
You've come up with some really good ones here.
Yeah.
Mouse Guard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Mice Templar, obviously.
Yeah.
I think I'm out there. I think we're almost done.
What about his one, Scurry?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, well,
I'm going to say no on that one.
I'm going to say no.
Quick plug, Scurry Kickstarter 2.
Oh, yeah. 2 yeah.
Is running now. Check that out.
Get on it. Especially if you're in the US. God damn, take advantage of that.
Yeah.
Max Smith, former guest on the show.
Well, that's me done. I thought that was a bit of fun.
That's a good one. You mentioned Gru. That was one of my favourites.
Yeah,
it's weird. I used to read that when I was in secondary school, and then come back to it, and there's so much more to it that I'd missed.
Yeah,
when I just didn't get it.
Proper funny. Oh, there's only one other that I thought you might like. Is Dan is Hilda?
Yeah, that's great. Oh, that's fantasy. I'd say that's fantasy.
Okay,
that's really good.
Let's have another question. Right, we've got James Lawrence.
Do we have to take his question?
I know you're friends with him, but he has done a genuinely serious question. Would you believe it? I'm sensing that you're having trouble believing that he would ask a serious question, but let's go for it. It says, having done an all-out action slugfest with Waterbringer and a more character-driven emotional story with The Shattered, what other types of story genre would you like to explore within the world of Imerian Tales?
It'll totally depend on what I feel like doing at the time, because I'm just using the framework of the world to tell whatever story I want. So like I've got a bit of an idea for like a detective story that I'd like to do with the fantasy setting. I want to do like some pure horror with it as well. So it's kind of, I don't have firm plans at the moment for like specific, I want to try this genre. It's just kind of whatever takes my fancy, really. So,
oh, nice. We've got another great question here from Kate Ashwin at Kate Draws Comics and Widdershins. She did ask a funny question about Mark's looks, but we won't get into that. So she said, she's given us an actual question as penance, and I think this is one for all of us here. If you were able to completely excise one cliche from fantasy as a genre, what would you pick? Hmm. Normally it's me who asks the questions that no one's got an answer for, so well done, Kate.
At least you didn't say no. You know, it's going well.
That's a difficult one.
Yeah, if you could lose, if you had to lose something from it, what is there about the fantasy genre that you don't like that you wish you could just get rid of? This is to everyone. Please don't leave me hanging.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. That's a difficult one.
I'd like to get away from the whole sort of, look at me, I'm a wizard. You know, sort of, you know when people think, oh, he's reading a fantasy novel on the tube, they all think he plays Dungeons and Dragons and there's a wizard's cloak at home. Yeah. I'd like it to be a bit more cooler than that. Yeah.
Maybe just Tolkien in general, because he's shaped so much of it. Everybody references him now. It's like people feel that they have to have that blueprint. So yeah. People being free of that as a blueprint would be quite good, I think.
I think
who else has shaped it? Who else is? I'm going to say C.S. Lewis a bit.
Yeah,
the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe sort of trope. It still exists, doesn't it? I think. Yeah.
I think the Warhammer guys, as well as the Dungeons and Dragons, they really kind of. Mine would be the questing party of having like these cookie cutter kind of the elf, the wizard, the barbarian, you know, like they go on a quest of like half a dozen people, and they'd all be from the different races and all have a different particular skill.
Fellowship of the Ring thing, you mean?
Yeah, that's kind of like the mold for it, and then all of them seem to have followed that. I would like that to kind of be pushed to one side.
Yeah, the quest to travel across the country to do something is definitely something that you see over and over again, don't you?
Yeah.
If anyone's watched Clerks 2, have they ever seen the impression of he does of the three Lord of the Rings movies?
No,
I've seen the film. I can't remember what the impression was.
One of them's just him walking. The second one's just him walking. And then the third one's he's walking and dropping something. There you go. That's the three movies.
I mean, I think it's... I don't think we'll ever see it. But the creation of like a new sort of fantasy creature or breed or type of character that will become as big as an elf, as a troll, as an orc, it seems like everyone seems to have got those standard ones, haven't they, really?
Yeah.
Now? And there are lots of new characters, you know, new creatures being created all the time. But it'd be nice to see a new one come, you know, be able to join the rest of those. But
I mean. Generally, I prefer the. We'll go back to Game of Thrones here. In the first kind of the books up until the point and the TV series, you had characters on different sides facing off against each other, and you would have like I like half a dozen characters on this side and half a dozen characters on that side, and kind of the battles they were fighting, you had stakes on either side, and people you gave a shit about, and it was always kind of like the battles weren't kind of black and white. But as the series has progressed, you've got now like these the dead, which are just totally, there's nothing there to kind of side with. And then you've got the kind of good guys. And I've not liked that shift away from the kind of the heavy politics and characters going up against one another to what it is now. So kind of that, that faceless enemy is coming kind of something that, I don't know.
I like that. Do you know what I mean? It felt like, going back to that show, that show almost lost me when it was just going a bit too slow. I know some people have sort of pace issues with it, but I'm thinking, finally, you know, we're seeing some stuff that I like.
Yeah, it's just kind of the foot just seems to be going a bit too fast down on the accelerator at the moment for that series for me.
It's going to be interesting when we get the last series in a couple of years.
It feels like we've been robbed of, like, when that, the lady of the High Garden, I can't remember the character's name, but kind of her speech to Jaime Lannister, if that was written by George R. R. Martin, it would have been so much better. And it felt like it was kind of written by a couple of jobbing TV guys. And it felt like we've been, this moment of the big moment of the story had been kind of taken from us just because, to be fair, they're in a kind of a bit of a tough spot. They've got to make that show because... Yeah. They can't say, "Oh, we'll wait until George does the books, and then all the cast fuck off." And
I tell you, this is a nice segue to our last question of the evening, shall we say? Good old Gareth Slightholm at Heeser on Twitter. He said, "In fantasy comics expanded from other literature, from the Hyborian Age to Middle Earth and beyond, have there been any worlds or characters?" Or ideas from other media you would like to see explored in comics, if not adapted wholesale?
Oh, that's a difficult one.
In terms of, I would say, like, a fantasy range of books that I'd like to see an adaptation of in some kind of way. And I'm not heavy on reading fantasy books, but I think when it comes to prose, for instance, I think when it hooks you, it really hooks you. I'm sure, like, the Abercrombie books been like that for you, haven't they, Mark? So, you know, once it gets you, it's not letting go. But I love the books of Scott Lynch, which is the Gentleman Bastard sequence. The Lies of Locke Lamora is the first one. There's three books.
I've read that one. I've not read the other ones yet.
Oh, it's just awesome. They're amazing books. I've got all three. That's fantasy in a it's more Venetian style, really. It goes off in that direction rather than, like, big dragons and... You know, it's still a fantastical world that's been built up. I'd love to see something like that get an adaptation in any form, really. I think comics, with some of these grander sort of scales, comics is quite hard to do it in because you don't have the time or the space to do a lot of these sort of adaptations, I think, because you can't. You've got 24 pages per issue unless you do a graphic novel. There's things like the Great Trolltooth Wars. By PJ Montgomery and Gav Mitchell. They're doing something that's based on Steve Jackson's world, isn't it? And so that's a massive world, but there's one story, you know, you're following one tale throughout it.
Yeah.
But I think if you're trying to adapt, you know, just say a Joe Abercrombie book, Mark, do you think you could adapt that, or do you think it's just the world's too vast to try a decent adaptation of something like that?
I mean, there have been adaptions of Abercrombie stuff, but, like, the thing is, like, my answer to the question is no, I don't have any that I'd want to be adapted into comics, just because you don't need, I don't see the point in that adaptation. I don't see what it'd gain by being done as a comic, whereas if it was, like, I'd like to see if Joe Abercrombie, really like his stuff, if he's going to do a comic, I'd like him to write a comic, you know, rather than his world get, rather than him go, here's one of my books, make it into a comic, and then the narrative's purpose built for the medium. It was like I was saying about the reveal of Barristan Selmy, like you can't do that in any other medium, and so if you've got, like, a big thing like that as one of your main points, like you need this big reveal in your book, how are you going to do that? You know, in a comic where you got this visual sort of where it's like a visual medium, so you can't have that sort of stuff. So I don't know. Like, I'd rather just see him come up with something new, world.
Yeah, it's probably easier to do those sort of things with video games, isn't it? Where every game is a massive open world now, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, I think rather than, like, adapting, Because The Witcher started off as novels, didn't it, if I remember correctly? That's
Yeah,
which I've never read any of, but, you know, if there
Is they're pretty good. Like, I've read the he did stuff like when we were talking about Robert E. Howard, his were short stories that were in magazines and stuff like that originally, I believe. Mm. I think he's called Andre Sapowski, the author. And so his first book, The Last Wish, is a collection of short stories that were in these different magazines, basically. And they're all kind of like him doing his own version of Grimm's Fairy Tales, but Geralt's there. And quite fun. And then I read the first of the actual series of books, which is called Blood of Elves, I think. I really enjoyed it, but at the time that I was reading it, they hadn't translated the other ones because it wasn't a big franchise. Like, because there's been three games, and it only got big with this third one. Really, The Witcher 2 was fairly well received. The first Witcher had like a I believe you'd say like a cult sort of following.
Yeah.
So there wasn't anybody rushing to translate them, basically.
But the third one's an absolute classic. The hours I've poured into that game.
Yeah, I love the third one. It's the only open world RPG like that I've really enjoyed, and I haven't gotten bored of, because everything's written really well. Yeah. So all your little quests that you do don't feel like go do a bullshit fetch quest
because we
said so.
Yeah.
Even the bullshit fetch quests have got like the kind of sometimes an emotional core, sometimes a funniness to them, like a humor and stuff. So all that little bit of writing is just really nice. So,
and the supernatural stuff is generally quite not scary. You can get chills from it.
Yeah, the monsters in that sort of series, they're genuinely scary monsters. And you genuinely have ones that you come up with that you just think, oh, fucking hell.
Yeah, when I remember doing the you do the Red Baron quest, and at the end you meet like those three witches in the swamp.
Yeah.
And I remember after doing that, there's no repercussions for going through the swamp, but I avoided it.
Yeah,
I didn't want to go through there because it was like,
I can't remember the one quest that basically there was like a jilted lover. And every kind of sundown, she appears like it's kind of like a ghost-like thing.
Is that with the tree?
Took me ages to fucking fight that. I think I had to got fucked over a couple of times. And I had to leave it and then get a bit more powerful to come back.
The one that got me was where you have to get. There's like this big haunted house, and you have to like there's some sort of body. There's lots of things buried, and I think you have to hide in a cupboard, or you have to eat something or make some sort of food, but there's something in this house. And as you're walking up to it, you know that, you know, everything's like really spooky. There are birds bloody everywhere, and it really gives you a sense of this isn't good. You're not going to get out of this very well.
Sorry, I just come back from answering the phone. What are we talking about now? That sounds quite exciting.
Video games, Tony.
Oh yeah, I'm all over that, mate.
and it's not Pong.
Oh. I'll tell you another thing, you get some fantasy books, comics that are set after an apocalypse, but they're all would you class them as fantasy, or it's always post-apocalypse? Because that again is quite
such a fine line.
Broad.
Yeah,
it depends. Because was it Vince put up a was it Vince or Tony put up a Korgoth of Barbaria? Facebook page.
It was Dan, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's me.
It was Dan. Sorry.
Yeah.
That's pure fantasy, but it's like in the beginning it's telling you like, you know, the age of man has fallen and all this sort of stuff, and everything's regressed and things like that. So I wouldn't call Korgoth post-apocalyptic.
Look at the DC comic Warlord, it's basically Journey to the Centre of the Earth's Core but with more fantasy elements in it. So it's kind of a weird mix up, you know.
Here's another last one, and it's pointed directly at Dan. What do you think the Dark Tower is, Dan?
Oh, I wrote that one down. I didn't ask. Yeah.
That's a difficult one.
Yeah. Oh, great movie, firstly.
I would go fantasy. Fantasy.
Hmm. Thing is, I kind of want to say fantasy, but there's something inside me that's saying no.
Yeah.
We're such geeks, aren't we?
I know.
I'm waiting for that film to come out on like home release so I can.
So you don't have to pay for it, you mean?
Hate over it.
But speaking of releases,
that's my life.
Yeah, you hate everything. Speaking of releases, the Shattered Imerian Tales Book 2, you're going to be releasing that at Thought Bubble, I believe. Is that right, Mark?
I am, yeah. I've released it online because I started with Imerian Tales. What I wanted to do was release the pages as I'm doing them so that people can see that I am still alive and that I haven't, you know, just disappeared somewhere. And also, you know, it gives people an opportunity to sort of get engaged with the story as it progresses, and then collect them afterwards to sell at conventions and sell like on my online shop and stuff like that. So I've released the last chapter like 2 weeks ago, I think it was, and I've got it ready for print and stuff. So I've got copies ready to roll for Thought Bubble.
Is it the same sort of finish as the Waterbringer?
Yes.
Awesome. So it's a quality little book.
Yeah, done through Comics Printing UK. Like, everybody should be getting their stuff printed there. So
you're getting paid for that, are you?
We need to get paid for that. Oh yeah.
It's funny because like the amount of people that come over and go, "Oh, this is really nice. This, where'd you get it printed?" And it's like, "Oh, Comic Printing UK. Oh, Rich, yeah." So he's like, from not having heard of him like 2 years ago to now, like everybody knows him. He does really, really good work. So
yeah. So
at Thought Bubble, you're going to have both volumes of Imerian Tales available. You also have prints and stuff, I believe.
I'm very, very low on copies of the Waterbringer now. I'm pretty much all sold out. So I'm going to take what remnants I've got left.
So you heard it here first, people. If you want the Waterbringer in its beautiful printed form, seek out Mark's table.
Rush in. Have a roll around with everyone else in the queue.
Yeah.
Fine. Yeah, run around. Be like Mike Reed saying, run around.
So I'll have a few of the Waterbringer left. I don't know when I'm going to do another print run of it, because the print run's fairly expensive. I kind of want to focus on the next book, basically, rather than,
I think because they're self-contained as well, there's no urgency to go back for another print run, is it? It's not like issue two. The issue I have is issue one is always going to be the issue that I'm constantly going to have to print, because there's going to be a lot of people's first. If you want to start the story, you've got to start issue one. But with Imerian Tales, you've set up a system that you can jump in at any time, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the idea. So, I don't have any new prints. I'll just be bringing the ones that I had last year, because I've just been focusing on getting the Shattered finished, basically. So,
he's been working on comics rather than anything else. Good man.
Good man.
Yeah. So, where are you situated in Thought Bubble? Do you know where you are?
Victoria Hall.
Ooh,
so,
yeah, because it's all a different layout this year, isn't it?
Yeah. That's the town hall. So we've got a few good people in there. I'm tabling next to Avery Hill Press and Rachel Smith, which is great. And James is in there as well. So is Kate Ashwin, Christian.
So basically, that's the tent where all the cool people are hanging out. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I never said I was one of the cool people, but if you want to say it, then I'll take it.
We make you cooler on this show. No, we don't. It's disgraceful. But you can read all of Imerian Tales online now, can't you? If you can't make it to Thought Bubble, you can read it as well as buy the Shattered online.
I haven't put it up online yet, because I'm releasing it at Thought Bubble officially. So after Thought Bubble, I'll have put it up online. The Waterbringer is still available to buy online, you can read the full comics like on the website. So
awesome,
cool.
We thoroughly recommend that people do that.
Yeah, I've only got one question for you, Mark. So, what is a Waterbringer?
No.
Nicely done.
We're going to have some recommendations in a minute, but do we have any little shout outs before we get into that?
Yeah, I've got a few.
Go on then.
Yeah. I'll do them chronologically because that's how cool I am. Oh. 29th September 5 to 7 is Pat Mills is doing a talk and a signing at Orbital Comics. around his recent books, which should be very interesting. Me and Dan are going to go, aren't we?
Definitely.
Cool, we'll be there. And our next big, I think our next big tabling event that we're going to be having a table at is Nottingham, isn't it, guys, I think?
Mm. Oh, I'm going to that.
Hey, oh, good man.
Oh, that'd be good. We can physically embrace. You heard me. Oh, it's going to happen. What is everyone's problem with my physical contact? Don't answer that.
Over eager.
Yeah, pushing the hips in is my problem.
Yeah. Hey, my hips don't lie. Go on.
Yeah. Which is the 14th to the 10th. Loads of guests. Lambo, Rachel Ball, Jay Gunn, Roger Langridge, Sarah Grayley, Kev F. Sutherland, NottinghamComicCon.co.uk, at Nottingham Comic on Twitter. And about an hour ago, their Kickstarter launched a charity anthology that they've launched, which is well worth your money. It's up on our Facebook page, and there's a few of us members of the group who are in that, including me. I've written a story in it,
nice,
which Kev has drawn, which Kev has done brilliant on. I love Kev's stuff. It's so funny.
Yeah.
And it's really improved my terrible story. So there you go. Go and back that, because it's well worth it. And I'll say it's for a number of charities. So yeah. well worth it.
There's an event this Friday as well in Orbital. Is it Orbital? It's got Lucas, Matt Garley, and another small press creator, which name escapes me.
Mike Garley.
Mike Garley.
There we go.
Someone else. Not Matt, Matt Garvey. No.
I get them mixed up as well.
I love it.
Oh, yeah, go and check that out.
Yeah, it's for Samurai Slasher Late Fees, which is a really interesting mix of autobiographical and the Samurai Slasher now genre, which I did a little review on recently. I really like it. It's a really interesting slant on it. Yeah, very good. Yeah. There you go.
Nice. Now, Mike Garley was at an event I went to yesterday, which was the wedding of Emily Owen and Gavin Mitchell.
Hey.
So from all of us at the Awesome Pod, congratulations.
Yeah, brilliant.
It was a lovely day.
Yeah.
Two of the nicest people in comics.
And one of our favourite couples as well, aren't they? They're brilliant.
They're the celebrity couple. What would be their celebrity couple name?
Oh, interesting.
Emily Lav?
I'm just going to say Emily Owen.
listeners,
Barack Gav?
Yeah, we need to come up with some sort of celebrity couple name for them. Listeners, help us out. Yes, so it was wonderful. Congratulations, guys. Long may the good years roll. It's this ginger beer I've been drinking tonight. It's gone right in my head.
Gone straight to your head, yeah.
Yeah. All right, calm down. Now, shall we jump onto the recommendations, gentlemen? Are you ready?
Let's do it.
Yes.
Yes. Who wants to go first?
Someone else go first.
I'll
go first.
Go on,
Ada. I thought I'd keep it with the theme of the night. And it's a Vietnam zombie Holocaust.
Hey! Yeah.
I had this review written a couple of weeks ago, and I'm damned if we're going to throw it away. It's going to be red. So we got sent in issue 1-3 of the comic. It's written by George Lennox. The artist is James Devlin, and it's published by Cult Empire Comics. I thought I'd kind of like got a bit of zombie fatigue with so much kind of zombie stuff coming out, but I really enjoyed this. It's a good little comic. It's 1969, and the Vietnam War is not playing out well for President Richard Nixon. Rising public protest and a real threat of losing the war leaves the president desperate for a solution. Enter Dr. Franklin Herbert, which is a nod to Lovecraft's, who has a plan: Operation Zombie Holocaust. The project proceeds with the president's approval, and a team of special forces soldiers are selected to undergo an experimental surgical procedure that will change him into an unstoppable fighting force that will bring the Vietnam War to a close. Meanwhile, in the shit, the 25th Infantry Division, aka Tropic Lightning, welcome two new recruits, Cooper and Clay. Their first day tasked them with clearing a Vietnamese farm holding a suspected of stockpiling weapons for the VC. What they find at the farm, though, shocks them to the core, and they now face an undead enemy that grows stronger by the day. The artwork by James Devlin on this really shines. There's moments that really pop, especially when he's kind of he's drawing landscapes or vistas of set in Vietnam. It does really well, similarly with the action sequences. George Lennox, cracking job on the writing. It really goes, this story. like it sets a blistering pace. There's not sort of like long periods of nothing happening. It's banging on all the way through it. And you, even though you kind of joined into this group of soldiers, the 25th, they all pop out with their personalities quite quickly, the soldiers. If I was going to have a little gripe about the title, is some of the juxtaposition in the storytelling kind of throws me off at times, and maybe it is intentionally done this way, but you have soldiers talking about like the horrors of the war in very sort of real terms, and then like they'd get attacked by kind of like a zombie animal or something, and it's kind of like it suddenly changes from being serious to kind of being like a bit grindhouse, you know what I mean? And some of it I was like, oh, okay, found it a little kind of jarring, but not really too much for a criticism that. I'll go and check it out. It's doing really well, the comic, and I have written down where you can get it from, surprisingly, which is if you go to www.cultempire.com, and I believe issue 4 might be out now, or it's going to be out soon. But they'll be doing the cons in the UK, so go and say hello.
Yeah, you do see them at cons, I think. Yeah, I've spotted them at cons on the odd occasion. Yeah, I think they might even be doing Thought Bubble, I've got a feeling.
Oh, nice one.
Yeah, okay.
Nice. Cool. Do you want to go next, Tony?
Okay. I tried to do a fantasy book, so I picked one out, but I don't think it applies to you picky nerds. I don't think it would be. I went for the new series of Turok, which has come out from Dynamite. Anyone read this yet?
No.
I think it's the first issue just come out, and the second issue is due any time. Has anyone read any Turok in the past?
Yes.
Okay, cool. So, you know, you kind of, Dan, get what it's about. It's a kind of Native American hunting dinosaurs. This spins it. This takes it away from it. First, you go through the credits. Written by Chuck Wendig. Art by Alvaro Saraceca. Colors by Triona Farrell. And letters by Taylor Esposito. And it's part of the Dynamite Sovereigns line, which is it also includes Magnus, Robot Fighter, and Solar Man of the Atom, or Woman of the Atom. It opens on a sort of cage on the back of a cart, which has been pulled by two stegosaurus, which have sort of car arrangement, like a cabin on top of them. In this cage, a sort of human and hybrid slaves, dinosaur human hybrid slaves are taken. And there's sort of two of them are pointing out this character in the corner of the cage, who's called, who they refer to as Turok of Railtown. He's asleep in the corner. The only thing I can't quite figure this out, because Turok was an indigenous person in North America, a member of a Native American tribe, as I understand it. Is that right, Dan?
Yeah, I can't recall his exact origins, because I can remember his reading it, and then it's kind of like he had those kind of tribal roots, and then it was suddenly like fighting dinosaurs, and I couldn't.
Yeah,
I think I might have jumped on like halfway through.
Okay. But in this, he seems to be a black guy. I can't. It's hard to tell from the art, I'll be fair.
Okay.
I'm not sure if they switched it, and we'll find out later on. I'm open-minded around it all, but we'll see what happens. It's basically set in the Lost Valley still. So in the original, the gold, I think it's Gold Key, and then into Valiant, and then into Acclaim, it was a sort of Lost Valley of dinosaurs and stegosauruses and, you know, strange creatures, and he would fight them sort of thing with a bow and arrow, but in this it's more a sort of sci-fi Planet of the Apes mood to it. It's more like the humans are the slaves and the dinosaurs are the sort of lord and master, and the sort of dinosaur, the humanoid dinosaur creatures have got they kind of wear sort of pseudo SS army uniforms, sort of thing. It's got that little bit of a sort of trope to it. I'm going to say I hate this sort of thing, but this summed it up for me perfectly when someone said it's a cross between V, the TV series, Planet of the Apes, and the original concept. And if you sort of smoosh them all together, you're going to get a little bit of a feel of it. It starts on a sort of a prison break. He's cunningly breaking into a prison to break someone out. Quite good in action, a little bit decompressed probably. Two of the people who had sort of prisoners with him join in with him and pick up sort of guns and fight as well. Pretty good. It's available, as I say, it's available through Dynamite. The first one's out and the second one's about to come out. It's kind of cool. The last scene, I'll ruin it for everyone, is the governor of the prison riding around on a red Tyrannosaurus Rex, Why have Tyrannosaurus Rexes all got to be red these days? I don't really understand that. But this one is anyway. And he has to sort of fight it. So, interesting stuff. Yeah.
Nice one.
There you go.
Smile. Nice. My pick for this week is one of my picks from LSCC that I just absolutely rinsed on the bus, on the bus home. It's from Humanoids, who are having some crazy deals. And we thoroughly recommend them whenever we see them. But Whispers in the Walls by Humanoids is one that I picked up, which is a... It sold me because it seemed like a horror tale. And, you know, I'm a lover of horror. But this was so much more. And it was a book that over that weekend I kept sort of... We were almost selling Humanoids to people that dropped by our table, weren't we? Because we were like, right, check this out. Go and have a look, see what else they got. And it was one of those books that I kept showing people what the artwork was like inside this book, and it was beautiful. But story is this: Czechoslovakia, 1949. After the brutal murder of her parents, Sarah awakens in an ancient children's infirmary. As she meets the staff and other patients of the mysterious institution, it soon becomes clear that nothing and no one is as they appear. From strange medical experiments to long-buried secrets and imminent battles, the fate of humanity lies in the hands of young Sarah. Oh. Now, I thought I'd add one more. Now, this is from a writer, David Munoz, who's The Last Ones, and also the co-writer of Guillermo del Toro's The Devil's Backbone. Have you seen that film?
Yeah.
And that totally comes across. This has got Del Toro written all over it. If it was a film, he's the person that would make it. The artist is Terso, and colorist Yavi Montez. Once again, I've murdered names as we do every week. But this is so much more than just a horror story. It's definitely it's horror with fantastical elements. It's almost like a horror Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe in some kind of ways. That kind of feel about it. Because it starts off straight up supernatural kind of horror as this girl discovers, you know, she finds her parents and her sister apparently brutally murdered by this huge vampire-like creature. And even the vampire's design is very reminiscent of what they look like in Blade 2. You know, those sort of Nosferatu sort of characters. Definitely got that kind of design look to it. But then she wakes up in this infirmary where there's lots of other kids and there's weird things going on with them as well. You really get caught up in it. I just read it in one go. Because it's a period setting as well, that gives a nice... I don't know, I think I prefer these sort of stories when they're set in the past rather than modern day. I think if it was modern day, it wouldn't work for me. Is that weird? No.
Yeah. I get it.
Yeah. So, but because of that, and this is Czechoslovakia, so you've got old churches and like huge buildings, you know, the artwork has to be on point, and dear God, this book is beautiful. The artwork is reminiscent of Chris Wildgoose's work in sort of porcelain, very much that kind of style, not as detailed in sort of like, because Chris is ridiculous when it comes to designing buildings and stuff, but this has definitely got that sort of Chris Wildgoose, Humberto Ramos sort of style. Humberto Ramos also does a pin-up in the back. You've got vampires, you've got werewolves, you've got crazy sort of minotaur-like creatures as well, vampire sort of overlords. But the humans aren't... It's not monsters are bad, humans are good. You can see it gives you a sense from both sides as well, which is interesting. Just beautiful stuff. I mean, I don't want to spoil too much about it. And I kind of want to talk about story points, but if I talk about them, it will actually spoil it. But it is 165 pages. I got it as a hardback, but I know you can get it on Amazon, on Kindle and paperback editions. And when you see it for yourself, it's just great stuff. And what I also liked about it as well, it's not, you've got the setting. The setting's great, but as Mark said earlier, it's the characters that drive the story. And it certainly becomes more fantastical as the story goes on, to the point of like there's big battles, there's huge assaults on sort of soldiers assaulting buildings, so you've got like soldiers taking on like monsters and things like that. It got a lot bigger than I thought it was going to be, but I loved it. It came out in 2012, so you know, it just goes to show that, you know, you get these beautiful books, but there's so many books that people don't know about. You know, I had never heard of it before, I'd never seen it before. I was sold on the cover because I'm a sucker like that, But I think when you check it out, it's well worth your time and your money. And it is a one-shot deal as well. I think that there may be story. It leaves it on a sort of sense where there can be more stories based around certain characters that survive, because there is a lot of death. A lot of death. You'll be pleased to know, Dan, there's some absolutely... there's some people that absolutely get mullered. I remember when I showed Dan one panel at LSEC, he was like, yes, someone was being mowed down by gunfire.
What's not like?
But as well as all that, there is a great sort of character story which will break your heart at certain moments as well. So definitely check it out. Search it out. Whispers in the Walls by Humanoids. Well worth your time and effort. I'm very proud to have it on my collection. God damn, they're putting out good books. So, Mark, what would you like to recommend to folks?
What are the rules for this? Because
we don't have any rules.
Just one book, or this? No rules. Cool. Because one of the things that I did was I put aside kind of like the books that are like the DNA of Amorian Tales, like comics wise. So there's a couple of them, that are, and then you know there's other recommendations I can do, but I'll talk about like these ones that kind of shaped like the stories. So first up is Barbarian Lord by Matt Smith. Anybody heard of that?
No,
I have not.
Yeah.
It's criminal that more people don't know about Matt Smith, because I think he's a lovely person, and he's a fantastic artist, and his stories are great. You might have seen his work in, there was a series called Lake of Fire, which was like Arthurian, like Crusaders versus Aliens.
Amazing.
No, what did that? I can't remember. Nathan Fairburn was the guy that wrote it.
Okay.
And Matt Smith did the illustrations for it, and that was really fun. But I really like Matt's own work. So, Barbarian Lord's basically like, it started out, I think, as a little bit of a joke that he did, where he's drawing like this really over exaggerated sort of barbarian character that looks a bit like an Arnold Schwarzenegger Conan character, and then it's sort of like evolved into like a full book, and it's got really strong vibes of like epic poems and just one man against this crazy world sort of thing. It's very funny, it's really nicely drawn, but it's also pretty brutal as well. And one of the it was one of the main points that when I mentioned before about designing the champion's armor, it was Matt Smith's artwork that I was looking at, because I'm just in love with his stuff. So I definitely recommend it. There's some fun bits, like where he when he kills someone, he sings a poem to them, like, but in the style of like an ancient Norse poem, so it's all like metal as hell.
I'm sold.
Really, really good. I picked it up on a whim and absolutely fell in love with it. So, Barbarian Lord, definitely. You've probably already read this, By Chance or Providence by Becky Cloonan.
No, I have not.
I know of it. I haven't read it. Yeah.
Amazing. It's I picked up the original zines that she was doing. To say that the zines, they were like mini issues.
Oh, those short stories that that she did.
Yeah. So there's Wolves, the Maya, and Demeter, and each one of them just gets more and more beautiful, like the further into the book you get.
Yeah.
There is a new version that's come out that's coloured by someone who I can't remember off the top of my head. He's worked with, I think he works on Southern Cross with Becky Cloonan and Andy Bellinger. But to be honest, I really like the black and white version. If you can find the black and white book, it's just gorgeous, because her artwork's just stunning, and like inking wise, it's something to aspire to. So they're really good, like these short sort of they feel like fables that are being told to you. They're really, really nice. So that's the second part of the DNA. The other one is another, might be obscure, I don't know. Are you guys Guy Davis fans?
Yes.
Yeah. Have you ever read The Marquee Inferno?
Yes, I have. Yeah, I really like it. Yeah.
Yes, it's amazing. So it's
an amazing line, isn't it? He's got so, yeah. I saw some of the pencils to it as well a few years ago, and look, fucking hell.
Yeah, I'd never heard of it before. I can't remember why I picked it. I think it was on sale digitally on the Dark Horse app.
Right.
And so I picked it up, and it was just amazing. As I couldn't put it down, basically. So it's about this guy who is it's set in Venice, I think,
and yeah, it's sort of like, right,
yeah, it's like 1700s, and this guy is basically like he's killing people for the church, but then he finds out that that he's not been doing the church's work. He's been doing like the work of the devil, and the devil's like given him this ability to take in these demons and send them back to hell. And the idea is that each of the incarnations of the Marquis, like they have like a different, like the demons have like a different animal theme to them that right. symbolizes their escape. And so the original one, because there's like it shows you like one of the old Marquis, and like some of the, like this version that I've got's got loads of like the sketch work and sort of notes in the back. So the original one was like the demons were based off of birds, so it was like, you know, their flight from hell. And in this incarnation, they're all based off horses, and so they don't look like horses, but they have like, you know, bits of horse skulls on them and stuff like that. And like the main devil looks like a big horse creature and stuff like that. And so that was a bit of the inspiration for having like one strong visual, you know, for like a character's armor or something like that, was the like the idea that there's this one sort of thing that symbolizes this escape. Just really, really good. There's a couple of, there's two mangas that I can recommend, okay, as the last bit of the details of the DNA. Sorry, one I'm guessing that people will have heard of Berserk.
Yeah,
it's one of Dan's favorite books.
One of my favorites. Yeah,
by Kentaro Miura. Just fantastic stuff. It starts off as like the most adolescent tosh ever in like the first three books,
yeah,
and then just turns into one of the best fantasy things that I've ever read. And he's at the moment he's really taking his time getting the chapters out. But when you see the artwork, it's just unbelievable. Mm. So definitely recommend that one. And Blade of the Immortal, if anybody's read that.
Yes. Oh, yeah, I haven't
read any of that, but I am looking forward to that film.
Hiroaki Samura, Blade of the Immortal, it's fantastic. Like I got onto it like the other year. And there's the way that he draw the way that the action's drawn in the book, it's just amazing. And so that's one of the action references that I always go to when there's a fight in like the 25th volume or something like that, this huge dude against Manji, the main character. And I was looking at that for like how the dynamic of the fight worked when I was doing the Waterbringer versus the Champion. It's a brilliant series. So set in feudal Japan, it's about like sort of the death of the sword school. There's this sword school that's going around crushing all the other ones because they're like, we are going against all this formalized sword nonsense. We're going to be able to use whatever weapons we want and stuff, and we're going to show you how ineffective like traditional samurai stuff is. And at the same time that this is going on, there's a swordsman who's hired by this girl to get revenge on these guys. The baddies are called the Ito Ryu, and the main character Manji, he's to atone for his sins, he's taken on this thing called this bloodworm, which means that he's got incredible healing. So he was like as you do. So he's got like this. He was a really famous swordsman and really good, but he gets worse when he's got this ability to stay immortal because he doesn't need to try anymore. So a lot of the stuff is him getting hacked to pieces and figuring out ways of like you're messing up the other people. It's really, really interesting. So yeah, they're like the DNA ones that I wanted to recommend. If we're giving shout outs, Owen, who you had on, was it 2 months ago or something like that?
Yeah, about right.
He was he's still putting the funding together for Real Love, which you know, looks really good.
Yeah.
And he asked a question before, James Lawrence. He's got a new book coming out at Thought Bubble as well. He does a comic called The Legend of La Mariposa, which feels like a kind of
Love
like if
book.
if you ever read Asterix when you were growing up, it's got that kind of vibe to it. And so he's got the online comic, which is one thing, which is one big story that he's working on. And then for the conventions, he releases short stories that don't tie into that don't tie in directly to the web comic. So you can kind of, you've got like two avenues to go there: this big story and then these little stories. And he's got one of his new little stories that's out Thorwall this year. And I've seen bits. He's been very coy with it. He's shown me bits and pieces of it, and it looks really good. So,
no,
nice one,
lovely.
Yeah.
So basically, the listeners are spoilt for choice this week, aren't
God,
they?
Yeah.
Got so much. It's almost a fantasy in itself. The shopping list we've just given you.
We could do an episode on Number of My Fantasies next week, couldn't we?
if you don't want to hear that, there is several ways you can get in touch with us to tell us, please don't let him do this. You could email us, awesomecomicspod@gmail.com. Likewise, if you've got any new comic events, etc., that you want us to shout out about, email us at tony.awesomecomicspod@gmail.com. There's no excuse not to get in touch with us, you see.
Yeah.
Follow us on Twitter @TheAwesomePod. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/awesomecomicspodcast. Join the place, the most fashionable place on Facebook, which is our group chat, Awesome Comics Talk.
Yes.
Yes, go on there and get stuck in. That's all I'm going to say. That's all you need to
Loads of good stuff's gone up while we've been talking, actually.
Yeah.
A little bit of advice asked for. And yeah, good. Good stuff.
Yeah. Sometimes I don't check it for a couple of days and I come back and just think, oh, bloody hell, this is active.
Yeah. I have to say, we had a comment on there, was it yesterday, from Chris Imber, about just talking about fan art and stuff. And everyone, I think it might be Sam, actually commented and said, look, this has been a really sensible talk. I'm actually impressed, because every other board he's on, everyone ends up having a fist fight over this subject. So well done, everyone.
That's the thing is, if there's anything, it's sensible discussion. And if anyone takes umbrage with anything, then it can be sorted out. That's what I love about our group. That
we sort out in the car park.
Yeah.
Now we're talking.
Yes. Speaking of car parks, thank you for listening to us wherever you heard us. Whether it was on the website, I don't know what it's got to do with car parks. Maybe people are just parked in a circle, just pumping it like really loud. I don't know. I just said pumping it really loud. I can't believe it.
Is that Shirley Hills? Is that where you go, Dan? Is it?
I go.
Anyway, thank you for listening, whether it's on the website awesomecomics.podbean.com. If you listen to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Podnose or Podknife, or wherever you listen to us, if there's a chance to leave us a review, please do. It helps get the word out, and the more people that listen to this show, the more people discover all these awesome comics that will therefore make you broke. Thanks.
Yeah. I've got so much from London Super Comic Con I've not even dented.
Yeah, we're gonna do a show fairly soon that will be fairly recommendation and review centric. So keep.
Well, and I'll tell you what, if you want, we've still got a few prints left over, haven't we? If you want a print, then contact us.
Yes.
Yeah. We can sort something out.
Yeah.
It might involve somewhere in a car park, but mostly in the corner of the car park. Fair.
Is that the big character print that you did?
We've got a few, yeah. That's a very good one. Yeah,
I was going to put something in for that, but then I'm like, I don't have a main character.
But you didn't, did you? Maybe
it should have just been like a flying E or something, like the symbol of the web comic or something.
Yeah, could have done that. But I think there'll be another one. I've got to be honest.
Definitely be another one.
Will there? Right, okay. Where can people find us online, etc.? Tony?
Ezohyz. It seems to be that a lot of review stuff is coming in quite fast now on the drive up to Thought Bubble. So there's been a few reviews gone up in the last few days, and a few more due. So keep an eye on it.
Awesome,
splendid, Daniel.
You can follow me on Twitter @VanguardComic, and you can read Vanguard Comic issue 14, which has just started now, at VanguardComic.com.
He's a beast. He does not stop. You can follow me on Twitter @JesterDiablo, and you can find out more about my comic at theredmaskfrommars.com. Mark, thank you very much for joining us for this.
Cheers, Mark.
Fantastic.
Oh,
no,
it was a pleasure.
Yeah, it was your first podcast appearance, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's the first time I've done an interview, so hopefully everybody won't hate me after this. So.
Everyone,
he was horrible. He just kept saying no to Vince. Vince is a darling.
I'll tell you what, right? People abuse me wherever I go, so they're not going to call me a darling.
They call you other names.
Yeah, that's true. But where can people find you and Imurian Tales, etc.?
So I'm on Twitter, which is at @M_D_Penman, because someone had MD Penman. I know, right? I also have been posting on Instagram lately, so I'm at MD Penman on Instagram. I have a Facebook page, which I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head, but if you search my name, it'll show up. Imurian Tales is just on the Imurian Tales website, so it's imuriantales.co.uk. And like Vince mentioned before, there's the two tales that I've done so far on there, all available to read. And there's a link to the, I think it's a Big Cartel store that I got. So if you wanted to buy a hard copy off of me, then yeah. And
that's
I'll be at Thought. So.
Splendid, yeah. Find them at Thought Bubble if you're going, which I know a lot of our listeners are. So there you go. Thank you very much, as always, for listening, folks. It's been fantastical. I was going to quote Conan then, but I can't remember any of the words. So instead, I'll just say thank you very much for listening. Stop trying to put me off. And from Dan, Tony, Mark, and myself, have an amazing week. Don't do anything too naughty. And as always, stay awesome. See ya.
See ya.
Bye.
I can only get a certain radius from London, and then I start dematerializing.
Then
I'm the opposite way around. Like if I go too far south, I just start to like I turn to stone. So
you get hard.
Yeah, oh, I rock hard.
Yeah, to bring the Tony element in there. Yeah.